should see it. I think you should, right? I'm working for the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce. There will be lunch, there will be lunch in the buses, but we have a boxed lunch, and you can eat on the way. And so we'll go back to the hotel after we finish here this morning, and then you can take all your things back to the hotel, and then we can go from there. And it's very casual. Wear comfortable shoes and a jacket, and bring along a raincoat if you have one.
Maybe a little cold, so have a sweater if you...
It tends to get windy out there by the bridge, and we'll be getting off there.
Has anybody seen him this morning? I delivered him at the hotel at 9 o'clock. I don't think he did. Maybe you have a call.
Parallel study.
Two bankers.
Yeah. That's the end of the tour this afternoon. We will go to we'll take a cable car ride from Powell and the Market across to Fisherman Wharf. And there, then we will get off the cable car and walk to the Belgium team. And I think we've chartered a car, a cable car, which will be at Powell and Market at 6 o'clock. We have to be there at that time. And take a ride from the island to get involved.
Don't see him here, maybe I caused him to visit.
There's a story in Singapore where an Australian ambassador tried being a former Democratic American. But what he had really done was to prevent the students from visiting the Orchard Road Conference. And so he had cocktails with him and everybody down at the Orchard Road Conference where he could arrange this formal table with candles and everything. And they served the normal food from this car park. I thought that was really funny. His father died. Harry?
Well, around
including some very
Hey, good morning. Sorry for the delay in starting, especially as I'm the reason for getting you all here early. I appreciate your coming. I've been asked to ask the paper presenters, if they can, to try to summarize their papers in about 15 minutes, because I think there's a lot of interesting issues that have been raised by the papers and raised in earlier discussions, as I understand it here. So we want to have ample time to air those and get the kind of vigorous discussion going this morning that I understand we've been having during this conference. So if I might begin by asking Saracen, the opponent, if he would give his presentation.
Thank you very much, Paul. Well, what I'm about to say this morning is really nothing new for most of you who have probably been exposed to the issue and to the subject for so many times already. But like some activities in life, I guess, one doesn't mind starting it from the beginning again, and then hopefully we'll still find something or experience some new perspectives as we go along. I hope this morning, my presentation this morning, although very brief, will stimulate something new in, by way of discussion, although I don't expect to see a consensus of views. So without further ado, if I may start my formal presentation. I'd like to start by saying that the significance of the United States to ASEAN can be seen from both economic and political perspectives. Economically, the U.S. Is among, as you know, ASEAN's top three trading partners, while for the U.S., ASEAN is its fourth largest trading partner. This is all down in the paper. The rate of increase in the volume of trade between the two sides has been tremendous over the past decade in particular. The U.S. Has been a major investor in ASEAN, in addition to that, in both energy extraction and manufacturing industries. And in recent years, the significance of ASEAN-U.S. relations has been enhanced by discussions of a possible Pacific cooperation scheme in a region identified with the world's fastest growth rate. When Japan is figured into the picture, these relations take on an even greater meaning. ASEAN's political consolidation in the wake of Vietnamese and Soviet expansion in Indochina and in Southeast Asia have added another political dimension to this significance. And the fallout between China and Vietnam has contributed a new challenge as well as opportunity for the United States and ASEAN. And what used to be the popular forecast of doom had proved exaggerated as new confidence was slowly being reestablished. As the non-communist nations in the region appear more and more capable of coping with the various exigencies. There has also been more consciousness in Washington about its potential contribution to regional stability as ASEAN is seen increasingly as a politically viable partner. There's affinity, I think, in the U.S.-ASEAN relationship affirmed by an identity of views and stands on, taken by the leaders and the people of both sides. ASEAN government leaders and public figures are generally conservative and pro-Western in orientation. And they are, I think, committed to some form of free enterprise. President Reagan's own conservative philosophy and his unequivocal, what I call unequivocal, anti-communist stance have further brought the U.S. and ASEAN leaderships, which have closer together. And particularly, their perception of a their common perception of a threat, and the common belief that the United States can and does serve as a counterbalance against the Soviet Union and Vietnam, which in turn would enable ASEAN to further realize its own potential. This new development has breathed new life into the traditional alliance between the United States and the ASEAN member countries of the Philippines and Thailand. I think it is a well-known fact that the United States has rationalized the importance of ASEAN as a major, quote, major force for stability of central importance to the U.S. interests in the region. This stand taken by Washington has been expressed primarily in political terms. In the first place, there are the vital military installations in the Philippines, which serve as the focal component of the United States, the U.S. Pacific and Indian Ocean military strategy. Washington views the role of the United States 7th Fleet as the main instrument for maintaining U.S. interests and regional stability vis-a-vis its main protagonist, namely the Soviet Union. In the U.S. strategic planning, the regional friends and allies, ASEAN countries included, are encouraged to contribute to defense burden sharing. In the sense of comprehensive security, the development of ASEAN as a viable economic and political entity strengthens the U.S. position in Southeast Asia. And the principled ASEAN opposition to Vietnam's effort in Cambodia is seen helpful in frustrating communist expansionism. In several ways, the current role assumed by ASEAN is regarded as more suited or effective in dealing with such regional problems as Cambodia. Finally, in the U.S. Strategic thinking concerning the Pacific region, ASEAN's role is increasingly appreciated. ASEAN naturally falls in with the current Washington thinking that a cooperative security arrangement encompassing all friendly states, including ASEAN, is crucial in responding effectively to the growing Soviet challenge. However, when it comes to implementing the foregoing strategy or line of thinking, I think the United States faces certain constraints. Basically, U.S. interests are, as Assistant Secretary of State Paul Wolfowitz often declares, if I may be permitted to quote you, sir, these U.S. interests are both global and regional, or regional and global, whichever order you like to place it. In addition, issues and questions are bound to become more sharply focused as relations between Washington and countries of ASEAN become more intensified. Therefore, notwithstanding the official U.S. pronouncements about economic ties as constituting the cornerstone of U.S.-ASEAN relations, as Secretary Schultz would like to point out. Washington has been regarded as discriminating against imports from the from ASEAN. While such complaints against the U.S. are probably not as loud as those against Japan, as our former Deputy Prime Minister pointed out yesterday, they are serious enough. The sentiment extends to the area of technology transfer, as I think Ambassador Brooke pointed out yesterday. Recently, the U.S., along with other dialogue partners of ASEAN, has pledged its cooperation in developing ASEAN's human resources. It is still too early to conclude if anything concrete will come out of this or will evolve from this proposal. In the meanwhile, ASEAN is facing the serious problem of falling commodity prices amidst increasing restrictive markets. Such impacts, I think, are potentially destructive for ASEAN economies, as has often been pointed out. And in the middle of this, the larger concept of the Pacific cooperation, as advocated by Japanese and American leaders, is somehow regarded with apprehension by ASEAN as perhaps being an evasive tactic on the part of the major powers. I'm just trying to be a little provocative this morning so that these issues can be discussed. I think while both the ASEAN and U.S. share the common concern about the growing communist challenge, as I pointed out a moment ago, the U.S. is more preoccupied with the Soviet naval activities centering around the Kamlan Bay, while ASEAN feels the immediacy of the Vietnamese threat via Cambodia with the Soviet support. On the Soviet threat itself, there seems to be a divergence of views as to the precise nature of the Soviet threat. ASEAN seems to feel that the United States wishes to have ASEAN oppose the Soviet Union, while ASEAN, realizing that the Soviet Union indeed constitutes a threat to its well-being, would rather see Southeast Asia free of external power rivalry. ASEAN sees the U.S. military presence in Southeast Asia at this juncture as a positive factor in ensuring regional peace. There's, however, some apprehension about U.S. preparedness to respond adequately and promptly to crisis situations which may arise. Since ASEAN realizes the U.S. Primary security interests and commitments are presently focused elsewhere, or seem to be focused elsewhere, the current U.S. stand on Cambodia is an issue where such feelings prevail. ASEAN basically expects the U.S. to have a greater input in the search for a political settlement to this problem. The timing, according to ASEAN, is crucial for a show of leadership by the United States in this issue. The apparent U.S. hesitation to escalate the conflict by direct involvement is understandable, but on the other hand, ASEAN thinks that Cambodia has from the beginning been internationalized by the full-fledged Soviet support to Vietnam in any case. So in addition, there is also the need to give ASEAN unswerving support for the latter strategy for a comprehensive political settlement. And this is where ASEAN feels that the U.S. is still lacking in exerting a leadership role. And a lack of response, a positive response by the United States, can also be misconstrued by both Vietnam and ASEAN, as pointed out by Dr. Pike yesterday, or the day before yesterday. And the outcome may not necessarily favor the U.S. interests. In spite of all such problems that I've raised, U.S. ASEAN partnership is enduring in view of the basic mutuality of interests. Yet certain realities should be discerned, I think, from this fact. And in the first place, ASEAN has had to face the communist threat while being burdened with the task of development, which makes the ASEAN share of security responsibilities for regional stability and prosperity even heavier. That's the first reality, I think. Second reality is that currently the U.S. economy is on the upswing, aided by the strong dollar, as pointed out by Ambassador Anand yesterday. Under these circumstances, the U.S. is in a position to be more accommodating to ASEAN economic requests. In the final analysis, ASEAN's ability to perform its economic and political role will hinge upon the soundness of its economic strength. If the U.S. desire for a collective endeavor among its friends and allies is to be fully realized, it behooves the United States to act as ASEAN's dependable ally. U.S. relationships with friendly countries in the Pacific region are undergoing a challenge, or facing a challenge. The issues affecting U.S. ties with New Zealand, China, Japan, and the ASEAN require extra sensitivity on the part of the United States of its counterparts in the region. At the same time, the weight carried by the U.S. can also influence Vietnam's eventual willingness to come to the negotiating table. This then ought to be compatible with the present U.S. administration's toughness or demonstration of toughness in vis-a-vis the Soviet Union in order to secure détente. In other words, more U.S. action should be forthcoming. The United States may be speaking of growing U.S. commitment to security in the Pacific in terms of the growth of the Seventh Fleet. But at the same time, the United States ought to be more actively responsive to the ASEAN effort to seek seek political solidarity and economic growth as the main strategy to deal with the overall communist threat. This is vital for the creation of the kind of Pacific community that would benefit both the United States and ASEAN in the long run. If I may stop here and let it rest. Thank you very much.
May I thank you for a very concise summary of a very excellent paper, and I appreciate that you have made some provocative comments. That should be some meat for a good discussion. I'll turn next to Ansel Ramsey, who is going to summarize Don Weatherby's paper. I understand Don Weatherby's father died, and he's very ill and is unable to be with us. Sorry about that.
Professor Weatherby begins the paper by noting that, in many respects, the current political stability in the Southeast Asian region is remarkable, especially given the forebodings that accompanied the U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam and the subsequent collapse of South Vietnam. The area has been marked not only by stability, but by economic growth, which, as he puts it, has cemented the dominoes even more firmly in place. Domestic insurgencies have declined rather dramatically by a combination of political, economic, and military strategies. In short, the states are, given those forebodings, remarkably stable. And as he points out, the stability is even more remarkable because these 10 years have been marked by rapid economic growth. This economic growth in many parts of the world has been extremely destabilizing because of economic inequities, because of racial, ethnic, religious divisions. Those kinds of inequities and divisions have not caused destabilization in the Southeast Asian region. Still another factor which makes it remarkable is that Vietnam has demonstrated an open willingness to use force, moving across borders. Vietnam's invasion of Cambodia has polarized the region even more. This polarization has been linked to international alliances, making it in some ways even more dangerous. Despite all this, Professor Weatherby suggests Southeast Asia remains quite stable. He then turns to the U.S. vantage point, looking at Southeast Asia today, and suggests that Southeast Asia today, ASEAN, is now the cornerstone of U.S. relations with Southeast Asia. And he goes on to point out five aspects of current U.S. relations with ASEAN. One is political. He suggests that U.S. political relationships now with Southeast Asia, ASEAN, are both more stable, more firm, and more broadly based than in the past. It's not simply a security relationship. A second aspect is economic. He suggests that U.S. economic interests, commercial interests in the region have grown dramatically, along with the rapid and dynamic growth in Southeast Asia itself. A third point that he makes is that in Southeast Asia, there is an emerging framework of cooperation so that the kind of bilateral tensions that exist over, for example, import quotas can be reconciled or resolved with a minimum of tension. A fourth point is the rather striking fact that the Soviets have not been able to compete other than militarily. While the United States has a broad range of contacts with the ASEAN region, the Soviets have been limited largely, almost solely in fact, to military influence in the area. And then fifth and finally, he suggests the current political economic contacts with ASEAN are now backed by a much more sophisticated security arrangement with ASEAN than has been the case in the past. In short, from the U.S. vantage point, relationships with ASEAN, in many ways, very satisfactory. He then turns in the third part of the paper to a question of how this has taken place. Why is it that such a relatively satisfactory relationship has emerged when it seemed in 1975 that just the opposite, in fact, might be the case? And he suggests at least five reasons for this emergence. One would be the kind of leadership that is now in place in the ASEAN countries. It's a pragmatic leadership. In many cases, it's based upon a bureaucratic and technological support base. It is, to a large extent, non-ideological. It's aimed at addressing particular problems and solving those problems. A second aspect of the leadership is that it is strongly anti-communist, which certainly meshes with the outlook of the present administration. Second key factor, in addition to the leadership that is present in the ASEAN countries today, would be that in all of the countries, there is now a quite mature nationalism. They are countries that are secure in their identities. They are countries with very well-established governmental structures, in some cases, the present structure is somewhat fragile, but basically stable governmental structures in the context of secure national identity. A third thing that has contributed to the present situation has been the increasing ASEAN cooperation since 1975, and more especially since the Bali Conference in 1976. A fourth contributing factor has been Vietnam's failure, both as an economic model and as a political model. He suggests that in comparison with the ASEAN countries, Vietnam is now an economic pauper. He points out that Vietnam's efforts to achieve any kind of satisfactory political relationship with the ASEAN countries has failed because of its intransigence in Cambodia. The next and final point he makes is that the Soviet Union's military power is relatively irrelevant in terms of domestic politics for the Asian countries, the ASEAN countries. It has not been able to use that power effectively inside ASEAN countries to affect domestic politics. As a consequence of these five factors, then, he suggests, the ASEAN countries have emerged from 1975 to become a very, very dynamic, very, very stable region. He then turns to the issue of security in the fourth part of the paper. And in discussing security, he suggests that despite the stability, there are certainly potentials for conflict in the region. And he discusses very quickly four areas of conflict. One of them, the most obvious one, would be conflict between Thailand and Vietnam. He suggests that there is a clear possibility of serious conflict here as the Vietnamese come into Thailand and then Thailand, the conflict escalates. A second kind of conflict that is a distinct possibility would be more serious conflict between Vietnam and the People's Republic of China. Still another area of conflict would be intra-ASEAN conflict, especially over territorial claims. He mentioned this case, particularly the potential conflict between Malaysia and the Philippines over Sabah. And then a final area of conflict, potential area of conflict, would be territorial conflicts in the South China Sea zone. He goes on to point out that while there are potential conflicts here, that the conflicts are not that likely, that the situation now is relatively stable in all of those areas. He turns next to what he terms ambiguities, not so much conflicts, but ambiguities that are beginning to emerge in the ASEAN region. The first of these would be ambiguities over an increased defense role for Japan. There are ambiguities, he suggests, potentially between Japan and the United States. Japan is likely to become more independent politically of the United States. It is more likely to go its own way. Second ambiguity linked to this Japanese role in defense would be the tentativeness in the ASEAN countries over this role. Still a lingering concern over the potential effects of a greater Japanese defense role. And I think a very interesting point is that if Japan does take on a greater defense role, it is likely to become less willing than it is now to discuss economic matters, other matters with the ASEAN countries. It puts Japan in an even stronger position vis-a-vis the ASEAN countries. So there are ambiguities there over just exactly what Japan's role should be. A second area of ambiguities he discusses is just exactly what the United States has in mind for the People's Republic of China. Ambiguities, for example, over how far the United States is willing to go in helping China arm, and concern, especially in some countries in Southeast Asia, over the consequences of a rearmed or much better armed modern China. Another aspect he touches upon in his second point about China is a question as to whether the United States could bring China into nuclear negotiations as China becomes more and more of a nuclear power. Just how effectively can the United States deal with this particular issue? A third area of ambiguity would be the possibility of Soviet use of coercive diplomacy. Will it use that kind of diplomacy, for example, to back Vietnamese territorial claims? And then a final area of ambiguity, and I think I should read this paragraph because it touches directly upon the topic for this morning, is the ambiguity over Cambodia. He writes that in Southeast Asia, the continuing stalemate over Cambodia seems to have only the Soviet Union and possibly the PRC as winners. The author's position on this issue is well known to most of the people in the room. It is a wasting asset for ASEAN and Indochina. The longer it continues, the more deeply entrenched the USSR will become in Vietnam. The longer it continues, the more deeply entrenched China will become as Thailand's strategic partner, to the discomfiture of Malaysia and Indonesia. In either case, does it appear that the longer range common interest of ASEAN and the United States are being served by the prolongation of the crisis? He concludes with a final large section pointing out that despite the conflicts, despite the ambiguities, he believes that the major threats to the current situation come from inside the countries, from domestic instabilities, not external threats. And the title of this section is Regime Survival. He discusses three countries in particular. The most obvious and first would be the Philippines, suggesting that no matter who succeeds Marcos, how the succession takes place, the United States is going to have to deal with a very different situation. It will quite possibly have to enter new base negotiations, and that will have, to some extent, a possible troubling effect upon ASEAN. The second country he discusses is Indonesia. He suggests, in this case, that a member of the post-45 generation will succeed President Suharto. That person may have more difficulty because he will not have the kind of legitimacy that Suharto had as a kind of savior from the PKI in 1965. A second problem he foresees as a possible difficulty in Indonesia is splits between those Indonesian leaders committed to liberal democracy or some form of liberal democracy and a more fundamental Islamic leadership. He sees that becoming possibly a destabilizing factor. The third country, and again most relevant for the topic of this particular meeting, is Thailand. He suggests that in Thailand, the military seems permanently poised for a coup, as leading elements in the military either seek to find constitutional means or non-constitutional means to shift the balance of power in the kingdom away from the parliament, away from civilian political parties. He goes on to suggest that in light of the student uprising of 1973, in light of the so-called April Fool's coup of 1981, this change of power may be a rather violent one. He goes on to suggest, finally, that this change in itself doesn't necessarily cause troubles for the United States, that a military government in itself would not necessarily cause difficulties. The problem, he suggests, is not so much the military government as the consequences, that a military government might give a new boost to Thai radical politics and, as he suggests, probably the communist insurgency. He also suggests in a final sentence that if in some way the monarchy became involved in the change of power, that it might have serious consequences for legitimating functions in Thailand. He concludes the paper, finally, with a overall, I think, a very positive assessment of current relations, relationships between ASEAN and the United States, despite the potential conflicts, the ambiguities, the instabilities he's talked about. His final two sentences, let me just quickly read them. The greatest challenge will be to formulate a comprehensive foreign policy that will be able to integrate all aspects of American interest in the region, political, economic, security. It will be attuned not only to the complementarities of interest, but the linkages between them. Up to now, it has appeared to many of our friends and allies that our regional insecurities have allowed a particular vision of extra-regionally based threat to drive our policies. Finished.
Okay, thank you very much. If I could ask Ben Sampong to summarize your paper, please.
Mr. Chairman, Excellencies, and Dr. Scalabino, ladies and gentlemen. Firstly, I would like to say to you that this is the first time that I come to the United States and to participate in this omnidirectional purpose conference. I greatly appreciate the Asia Foundation, Institute of East Asian Study of the UC, and also the American Study Program of the CU, for inviting me here. Coming to the subject that I will present to you in a minute, the Indo-China factor in Thai-US relations, I would like to say to you that it is the delicate factor now that the US and Thai should come closer together to consider this factor for the sake of both countries and for the sake of the free world in this region. Coming to the subject, this paper focuses on the analysis of four major developments, but I would like to reduce into three that occur after the communist takeover in Indochina in 1975. That are the Sino-Vietnamese conflicts. The first is the Sino-Vietnamese conflict. The second, the Vietnamese occupation of Kampuchea and the increasingly close military and economic cooperation between Vietnam and Soviet bloc. And the third is the problem of the Kampuchean refugees in Thailand. I think that the third the three developments of which have some positive or negative effects on the relations between the two, Thailand and the United States. Firstly, the Sino-Vietnamese conflict, I think as everyone knows, the Sino-Vietnamese conflict has become visibly apparent since 1975, and the conflict has come to highest degree in 1979. From 1979 to 1982, it was the period of highest degree of conflict between Vietnam and China. And also it was a period of relief and relax for Thailand with respect to the security issue. Since we and China at that time have become to have common interest, that is to oppose to the hegemonism of Vietnam in Indochina. China and Thailand become much closer. Some said de facto alliance between Thailand and China has already been established. At that time, it seems to me that the United States prefer also to leave Southeast Asia to be under the umbrella of China and Japan. The Thai government at that time could also arrive at good compromise with China on the security problem. We could see no visible support of China to the communist insurgents in Thailand from 1978, and China has strong commitment for the security guarantee of Thailand, for the guarantee of the security of Thailand if attacked by Vietnam. The Thai government and Thai people, it seems to me, were happy to have good relations with China. As you know, at that time, various private and official trips have been exchanged between the people of Thailand and China. It was a period of great love or great embrace between the two countries, I think, at that time. And as for my opinion, I think during 1978 to 1981, the Thai, both the government and people, did not put much attention on the U.S. They thought that China would be the only country that could be good and effective deterrence for Thailand against the Vietnamese expansionism. However, after the normalization of relations between the China and the USSR, 1982. It seems to me a period of great love between Thailand and China began to change. The Thai government and Thai people began to be more cautious in having relations with China and vice versa. And a good number of people, of Thai people, began to be afraid of the strengthening of the communism again. This time, they are afraid that the new compromise between China, the USSR, and eventually the Vietnam would be realized and would have access to their cohesive relations again. Because if good relations could be realized, not only Thailand, but all non-communist ASEAN countries would be in trouble. And finally, liberalism, which is the core of fundamental rights of humanity, and the free will would disappear from all of Southeast Asia. This is why the Thai government and people are going to look for more US and other Western countries' attention in Southeast Asia, especially in defense and economic fields. That's not only for the security of Thailand, but also for the sake of liberalism which I think it is the core of fundamental rights of humanity. For the second development, that is the Vietnamese occupation of Cambodia and increasingly close military, economic, and cooperation between Vietnam and the Soviet bloc. Since the Vietnamese launched an invasion into Cambodia on December 25, 1978, and occupied Phnom Penh in January 1979, they still maintain a number of about 170,000 military men in Cambodia in order to keep Heng Samrin in power. Hundreds of thousands of the Cambodian people have fled the Vietnamese West Wat Drive to the common border between Thailand and Cambodia, and a large number of innocent persons entered Thai soil to find safer sanctuary. These refugees cause serious burdens for Thai government, both security and humanitarian burdens. Now, it is the seventh year that the Vietnamese have their 170,000 forces in Cambodia after its occupation of Phnom Penh. The Vietnamese have used and continue to use the brutal and inhuman means in killing the Khmer. With the USSR assistance, about 3 to 6 million US dollar a day. They have also intruded and still intruded intentionally for many times in Thai soil. This is for the Thai government and Thai people the real and immediate threat to Thai security. And if without the Soviet assistance, I think the Vietnamese certainly could not perform the big threat to this region. And when no big powers can persuade